This is Terry Ferschgott and Myrna Orsini and Swanson Vance Margaret. This is 13 December 1993, celebrating the creative psyche.
First one lobe and then the other. She screamed with the pain, but she did hold still. But after the second one, she fainted. Her ears firmly fixed to this rough-hewn planking beneath. So the boy quickly rushed up a house post and cut the net and carefully lowered the children and tumbled them out. Then he found some salmon and put bits of it into their mouth and got grease and covered their and put it on their eyes to soften the pitch that was ruining them shut. He gave them all sips of water. They revived some. The doll opened her eyes just a little and said, "I want my mother." And the boy said, "I will take you there right away." He hustled the children out of the house and into the clearing where the raven had called for two bears who would come lumbering out of the woods. And the boy got the children onto the bears' backs where they hung onto the shaggy fur, and the bears went off into the woods. There was reason to hurry, for other ogres might come and rescue Tezlamoka. On they went into the forest, and the doll finally opened her eyes. The forest isn't dark, she thought, and there was a beautiful green radiance that gave dappled shadows to the leaves and the mosses. And then she saw the beautiful boy, the spirit child, next to her. It was like looking at the sun through a morning sea mist. He was so beautiful. The doll smiled in happiness and closed her eyes again and put her head against the shaggy bear fur and let herself be lulled by the lumbering. She was roused by the sound of happy voices and the sound of surf. And there she was, back at the beach. And there were the parents running towards them, and she found herself in her mother's arms, hugged and comfortable and secure again. And all the children laughing and crying in happiness. Everyone was merry, except one. And that was Goodnex, who stood sour and sullen at the edge of the crowd. The parents all listened while the children told their tale of being caught and rescued, and they all laughed at the trick the boy had played on the ogress. As soon as she could, Gundax got close to the doll and whispered in her ear, "You stupid child, now you've done it. Tezlamoka will be worse than ever now." But the boy had overheard and seen the sullen looks and said, "I don't think so, for Tezlamoka only wanted beauty." And then he took off his dazzling ear ornaments and called to the raven and said, "Here, take these to Tezlamoka." And the raven took them in his beak and flew off into the forest. "And now," he said, "I must be gone." But he stared straight at Gundex and held his gaze as if he were considering. And then, seemingly from nowhere, he had a bow and a quiver of golden arrows. He took the arrows and shot them into the air, one after another, until they saw that he was making a long, glittering chain caught in the floor of skyland above. When the golden chain was almost to the ground, he turned and he said, "I have come to Earth before when I was needed. Once when I was dealing with unkind people, I turned a man into an ugly dogfish." He looked long at Gundax and said, "You may make a good crab, always snapping at little children. Or maybe a devilfish." Gundax fell to the ground, crying, "No, no, please, please, please don't change me." "Then," he ordered, "you must change yourself." And with that, he got hold of the glittering chain, and he was gone up into the sky, the arrows disappearing behind him. And so the children went back to their homes. And Gundak, Vidal, was worried and said, "Do you think she's right? Will she come back?" to her mother. And Sidal said, "No, I think he was right. What she wanted was beauty. And the earrings will make her very happy." The doll smiled and said, "Yes, I think she only wanted beautiful things, understanding perfectly." And so life was very happy for the doll. Once when Gundex snapped at her again in bed, she said, "Shh, shush, shush, the spirit child may hear you." And Gundex was quiet at once. And life for the doll was very happy.
Thank you.
Yes? That one is in a book by Christy Harris. It's called Totem Tales or some such. Yes? I do a little bit of editing or rewriting. This one was a lot longer. There was a lot more detail. It was sort of more literal, in a more literary fashion, and so I had to make it a little simpler. The folk tales are, you can pretty much do directly because they're already in a more literary fashion. I mean, in a oral fashion. Thank you very much.
Okay. My name is Terry Furschgott. I'm a Seattle artist. I'm 45 years old and I've been an artist my entire life. Tonight I was going to talk to you about my creative process and the development of my work and the development of myself with my work. I'm just starting up here so you can see what I look like, and then I'm going to go back and show my slides as I talk. I've always been an artist. I have two sisters, and we always did drawing and sketching. We made paper dolls a lot. And all through elementary school, I grew mostly horses. I was infatuated with horses, as a lot of girls are. And then as I moved into high school and then into college, I became very interested in Aubrey Beardsley and decadent art, Art Nouveau. And for a long time, I drew only in black and white. I liked the curving lines of Beardsley, the way he would form a composition, very flat, decorative kind of art that interested me. I was not at all three-dimensional, and I still cannot do anything in three dimensions except make a two-dimensional surface look three-dimensional. But when I was in college, it was during the psychedelic times. I did a lot of psychedelic posters with a lot of detail and these curving lines like Beardsley. And then just after college, I started doing a series of watercolors. And I think if this will reach, I'm going to go back now and start to show you some slides. So I guess we should turn the lights out. If it'll reach. And I thought the first thing to do, I thought first I would show you a piece, a recent piece. This is from last year, and it's pastel over watercolor. It's called Girls. And it's about 4 foot wide. So this is what I'm doing today. And then this is a piece from about just after college. It's about 4 inches wide, and it's watercolor on paper. And you can see the Art Nouveau influence, the tiny details like in the pebbles on the ground and the big curving shapes that bring the composition together. And I was interested in things being a little strange, and it was partly my age, and it was partly the age I was living in. If you showed someone an ordinary landscape, when I was in college, they would think it was nice, but if you showed them a landscape that was a little strange, a little trippy, a little psychedelic, they thought it was really nice. So, and I thought it was really nice. I've always, one question I was thinking about as I prepared this talk was, how much is one influenced by what people like? You know, what people tell you is good, and how much do you go ahead and do what you want to do? Anyway, I think it's a combination. These are all from the period right after I graduated college. During college, I was doing all black and white. And then I became interested in trying some color. And first I used Crayola crayons because I felt too intimidated by anything else. And then I gradually went on to these very small watercolors. And they were, as you can see, somewhat whimsical, a little surreal, very tight, very precise, but with, I think, with a strong interest in color and form and certainly in people, and all of those things I continued with. And this is from a little later, and I put it in as sort of the culmination of this period of my work. This was, I had just had my first baby, and I was very interested in everything domestic. And in technical terms, it was probably the most perfect picture that I had done in terms of it being what I wanted. Every part came out the way I wanted it to come out. So this was one style over a certain amount of time. At this point, this one, as I said, was a little later, but I moved to England and I lived there for a while. I studied oil painting. And I met the man who I eventually married. And after several years, we decided to travel in the East to go to India. So we traveled all the way across. For 2 years we traveled. And as my media of choice, I took oil pastel because I didn't want to take oil paints. They were too messy and pastel would rub off. Oil pastels were cheap. You could buy them anywhere. So I took them with me, and I had been doing the watercolors, which were basically all from my imagination. They were realistic up to a point, but they were all coming out of my head. I would occasionally look at my hand to know how a thumb went or something, but they were from my head. When we traveled in the East, I was drawing completely from life. I was using my oil pastels to just sketch people, sketch places, sketch scenes, and this was very good for me. It really pushed me in a lot of ways. I was getting away from the sort of self-conscious tightness of the watercolors. And then when we came back, I was pregnant and had my first child. And I was very much at home, and I still wanted to do oil pastel, and I wanted to draw from life. So I started doing, this is an example of larger pieces using domestic objects, since that's, I was sitting at home most of the time with my baby, and this is what was around. And so this is still oil pastel. And I look at it as more learning how to create compositions, learning how to deal with a media. I don't think some of it is coming from the inner me because it was domestic. But in a way it's more technical. After a certain point when my baby was a little bigger, I rented a studio. It was a big studio in Ballard. It was the first real studio out of my home that I'd ever had. It was very large and intimidating. I felt my work had to be bigger to fill the studio. And I also, at this point, I began to hear, and I always am hearing this critical voice which tells me what true art should be. I think recently I've finally gotten rid of it a little bit, but at this point it was saying, no one will take your work seriously if it's these little tiny illustrations. You know, you have to do bigger things and they have to be more impressive to people and then it'll be real art. So this is another one of the still lifes. They were getting bigger and I was pushing myself and trying to feel like I was a real artist. This is another one. I was learning, I think what was happening in these was learning about repeating shapes, learning how to create a composition so that your eye is drawn first to one, the viewer's eye is drawn first to one object, and then the shapes of the object and the way you're using the space draws the eye around to the other objects. So instead of just seeing this as, you know, you take all the things in your house and you dump them in a pile, it becomes an actual composition. Now, this is Margaret, in case you don't recognize her. But after doing the still lifes for quite a while, I decided that to be a real artist, I had to make some money. My husband is a psychologist, and fortunately, he was able to support me through all of this. But I felt that to be a real artist, again, in quotes, I had to come out. I started entering competitions and trying to be part of group shows, and I thought that doing portraits would be a good way to make some money and to do something I liked at the same time, because I liked to draw people. I hadn't been drawing people for a while, and I could relate to the people. I would have someone to talk to while I worked. But I thought to get people to hire me to do portraits, I'd have to have a collection of them to begin with. So I started asking my friends to pose. And this is still in oil pastel. And I tried to make the portraits more than just look like the people. I tried to make them say something about the people. So this one was Margaret sewing the little stuffed animals that she does. And this is a detail of the portrait of Margaret. And I put it here partly to show the use of color, color applied in little bits on top of each other, more in an impressionist style rather than rubbed together in any smooth way. And also to show the limitations of oil pastel, which I began to think about. Oil pastel, you can put a dark color over a light color, but once you've got a dark line, the light colors don't cover it. Whereas in oil paint or in chalk pastel, you can cover it completely, a dark with a light, and you can build. With oil pastel, you're somewhat limited. So these are a few more of the earlier ones, the portraits done in oil pastel. This was a sculptress, and behind her legs there you can see one of her pieces. And this is another detail, just to see more of the style. This is another friend who agreed to sit and pose. These were all obviously done from life, and they took quite a long time, so the person had to be willing to come back 5 or 6 times. And also, I was limited in the range of motion and the range of expression I could get because I was drawing from life, and you can't hold a smile or a dramatic expression for very long. So in a way, I had gone from working completely from my head to working completely from life, and I was unable to combine the two. This is a detail. This is the first portrait. I was still doing portraits, heading for a show which I had on Mercer Island, and this was the first one that was done in pastel and chalk pastel because I thought it would be a more versatile medium. And I also began at this point to do people with their children or people together, feeling that you've got much more of a sense of the person if they were in relationship with another person. And I think this interest in relationships and as well as in people is very much a part of me, and this is where it began to come out. This is a father and his daughter. And the mother was represented by the flowers. Those were her favorite flowers, but she wasn't in the picture. The detail of it. These are two brothers, and the little boy's teddy bear is under the chair. So I would do a whole lot of sketches and try to set it up so it said something about the people. By the way, the older boy with his feet on top of each other, the way they were positioned. I was very interested in Mary Cassatt, as you can imagine, at this time, and also in Degas. This is a couple, and I was working. They eventually got divorced, which it wasn't intentional. but I thought it'd be interesting to do a diptych, and I worked on trying to connect the two halves by the baby reaching and by the father's arm coming across and by the fan and then by the angle of the picture pointing across. I think it's just the statistics in the country. They also got divorced, but this was on picture. He was the veterinarian at the zoo here, and so she's holding a picture book of animals, and they wanted their cat in the picture. That's her name is Mary, that's the woman in the picture. So at this point I had my portrait show on Mercer Island, and it was quite successful. But at that point I began to feel this wasn't real art either. This wasn't good enough for whoever these people are, the powers that be in the art world that I was sure weren't taking me seriously. And I thought, and I think it's partly you know, a feeling in myself. But I think it's also partly an inner part wanting to come out and change something. You know, the voice, you can look on it as negative and not listening to yourself about what's good, but you can also look on it as pushing yourself. And so at this point I thought, well, really, to be taken seriously, you couldn't do illustration and you couldn't do any sort of narrative. The people couldn't be dramatic or telling a story. You had to be like Dega with his washing women, who were like, I mean, they're beautiful, but they have, there's nothing happening there. They're objective. They're like a cut out of a film, you know, where you have no idea what's happening and you don't even wonder. You just see how beautiful they are as objects. So that was my intention. I started hiring models. I had given up my big studio and had another baby and I was back at home. So I was interested in keeping it domestic. I was interested in women and relationships between women and in the beauty of everyday women's work and the domestic environment. So this was two women in the bathroom in the morning. And also, technically, I was learning more about light, more about color. They were getting larger. The compositions were getting more complex. The people were becoming part of the composition. Another thought I had in preparing this talk was about, because the series is about creativity, and I feel like everybody's creative and everybody, I truly believe everybody is an artist. But to be this kind of artist, the kind that I want to be a realistic artist, perhaps, you have to master the technical part. And the more you can master that, I've found the more you can access your inner stuff. The same way if you go to church or you go to temple, if you know the service and you know the songs so that you're completely comfortable and you can just do it, then your spiritual part can come up. But if you're worried and you're anxious and you're not quite sure how to sing it or what's coming next or how to do it, then you have to work on that. So the more you master it, the more the other part can come up. And I think at this point I was moving along, but certainly hadn't reached the point of mastery I wanted. This was three females in the kitchen. One's a little girl. And it's just putting away dishes and eating. Again, it's a domestic scene. And this is a detail of her skirt. You can just see some of the technical part, I guess. This is called the family bed. And this is one of the few, this series of women in domestic interiors became my first solo exhibition. I also at this time I thought you can't be a real artist if you're not in a gallery. So I went I started going around to galleries and taking my slides around, and eventually I signed up with the Lisa Harris Gallery where I'm still showing and represented, and my first show was this series. And this is, there are only two pictures with men in them, and some of them have little boys. But this is one of the few. I wasn't ready, or whatever reason, I didn't want to draw men at that point. And this man is, he's not too hostile, but he's sort of pulling her hair. And he's sort of pulling the whole picture plane in his direction. And that, I mean, it was partly compositional, but I think it was partly, I mean, I was happily married, but I think it was just something in there, you know. This is called Folding Laundry, and it's dealing with light and shade and color, and also with just something that a lot of women do every week. And it takes, you know, it's an important thing and a beautiful thing in its own way. And again, it's just women in a domestic environment. These are all from life. Yeah, they were all from models, and they would come and pose. And this one was on a deck, but I think it still counts. The thing about the domestic interior was, for me, was partly the safety of it. I mean, I was still working at home, and I didn't really want to go outside of the walls of my house, I think, internally. So it represented this safety, you know, it was keeping the outside out. And this is the only other picture with a male figure, and to me he was very threatening. I mean, I made him threatening on purpose. I look at him now, he doesn't look so threatening. He looks like he's just standing there, but at the time he seemed very threatening to me, this dark figure and this woman with her eyes shut in her bathing suit. So detail of it. Yeah, that, this one, sometimes they look better when you just cut them down. And this one was called The Secret, and it was four women having breakfast, and two of them are whispering, possibly about the other one. This one, and I think the next one, they were the last few I did for the series, and they were more dramatic and more narrative than the others. I was slipping, you know, my Degas image, something was pushing up, and I couldn't resist it so much anymore. It sort of begins to tell a story. And this was the last one of the series. It was called Dressing for the Wedding. And it leads into the next series I did, which was of Greek myths. And in fact, I used it in the next show as well as, I still just called it Dressing for the Wedding, but I thought of her as Psyche eventually. And this picture has more symbolism in it than the others, as well as being more narrative. It has the eggs and the lemons, which are Christian symbols of weddings, and it has the female-shaped vase. It has a wedding ring right at the bottom. It's sort of hard to see. And then it has the glass of wine with the light reflected. And in Christian, a lot of Renaissance painting, they'll have stained, like Van Eyck will have stained glass with the light coming through, and it represents the virgin birth, where the virgin isn't changed at all. I'm Jewish, I'm not Christian, but I studied art history, and it always fascinated me. So I put in all these female or wedding symbols. And then the narrative element was, why does she look so anxious, and who is this dark woman in the background, and what's really happening? There's a detail of it. This is pastel still. And I was using pastel on tinted paper, and you can see the sort of grayish paper coming through. And what I found by the end of this series was that pastel doesn't have very many dark, really dark colors. Oil paint has a lot of darker colors. With pastel, you have a dark blue and a dark brown, and you have black, and the rest really aren't very dark. So when you use tinted paper, the gray or the paper will come through the darks and make them less rich. And it'll also come through the light. So this paper was grayish, and where I wanted her arm to be really shining, it made the lights less brilliant and the darks less rich. After each of my big shows, I tend to take 2 or 3 months and do nothing. I mean, I go to my studio and I diddle around, but I don't do much. And then I usually find myself starting with something new, something small. And after that show, I didn't do anything for a while. And then I started doing, this is a very small picture, it's probably, it's about 1 foot wide or something. The one just before was probably 4 foot high, maybe. So this was a new experiment. It has watercolor under the pastel. And I think you can see, I'll just go back one. Oops. No. There we go. How this compared to this. This is much more intense. Because I started doing an underpainting of watercolor. It wasn't always the same color as is on top. But I could put black underneath the darks, or dark, a really dark watercolor, and that's what would come through the darks. And then I could put yellow or something really light and have that come through the lights, and it was really exciting to work with. So I did some little still lifes to learn about the color. And then I found myself going to this series of Greek myths. What I had liked about the women series was that it was somewhat archetypal. It was showing women doing, like, folding laundry, doing things that some of them are universal, or at least are universal in the United States and Europe, I suppose. I liked that archetypal idea, something that was basic to a lot of people. And then I liked, that seems to come out of myth a lot. And also at this point, I started seeing a Jungian therapist. And I had done some therapy before, but I had never had a therapist who was interested in my art. I had always felt like I couldn't talk about it because it was bragging, because I was good at it. And suddenly I had this person who liked art, you know, and thought it was important and thought it was coming out of me. And this was a really new concept for me, that it had something, that it wasn't just my hand, you know, copying things, that it really had something to do with my dreams and something deeper that was coming out. This was very exciting for me. So all through my doing this series, I was working with dreams, and it all went together very well, and I think it made it a deeper sort of thing for me. This was Psyche and her sisters. At the same time, I wasn't ready to go completely narrative and really, you know, put them in Greekness form with tunics and all of that and really make it a story. So I put them in contemporary dress, so if any critics looked at it, they wouldn't be too hard on me and they could say, this is almost objective still. But I put in lots of symbols, which often people, no one knew but me, to, this is all the watercolor under the pastel. Yeah. This is a detail from that. And this one was probably about 4 or 4.5 feet high. So they were getting bigger. I also got a bigger studio at this time. I take that back. I was working in a 10-by-10-foot room for this series. At the end, I got a studio. So I was still at home. The details. This was Demeter and Persephone, partly because of the therapy I was doing. My mother had died about 9 years before, and I have a daughter, so I was interested in mothers and daughters and in leaving and transitions. Eventually, the whole series came to be pretty much about transitions, which, of course, a lot of myths are about, transitions from one time of life to another. So in this one, this is the first one, this showed Demeter, the mother, who's gardening, and her daughter, and they're just happily gardening together. And then this one was in the fall, the leaves were changing in the trees, and it shows the mother with her growing daughter, and she knows her daughter is going to leave soon, and she's brought all these flowers into the house to prevent the moment from coming so soon. But she knows that the moment is coming. And this one showed the daughter going to be married or to be the queen or of the underworld. Or you could see her mother behind her in mourning. So it was about the leaving. This was Cupid and Psyche, or Eros and Psyche. And it was when she lights the lamp and she sees that she's married, her sisters have told her it's a monster, and she sees it's a god. And it was about, for me, it was about seeing the god in the person you love and showing that how beautiful they are to themselves. And it was also about learning to draw artificial light at night. And it was also about, you notice, there's a man in the picture. And at this time I was having lots of dreams about, with young men in them. And they weren't sexual dreams. These men were my friends. And I eventually saw that probably they were the other side of me. You know, they weren't some new lover I was going to find, but they were possibly the other half of me. And so some of this series, I think, is about that. This was Dionysus and his mother. Really just about a man and his older mother. But in the story, Dionysus brings his mother up from the underworld to live with him on Mount Olympus. Finds her an apartment, it says. And here she is folding his socks and living in domestic bliss. And this was Orpheus and Eurydice. And it's just before he turns around, and he's not supposed to turn around until they both get up into the sunlight. And it's just before he turns around and she disappears again forever into the underworld. And again, this was about as close as I got to a picture about men and women being physical together. It's just, I find that some people have one thing to do in pictures and some people have something else to do. And my critical voice at this point was saying to me, why don't you do something more sensational? You know, why don't you do something about incest or rapes or something, you know? Something more spectacular that people are interested in. Because I really was thinking this. I have a good friend who's a wonderful pastel artist, and he does great big sensational figurative pictures, beautiful pictures, you know, of pimps and prostitutes and transvestites. And I was really thinking, you know, that's what's topical today, but it was not in me to do. Which is another interesting thing about creativity. I mean, you can only do, which Myrna was saying, you can only do what comes out. What's in you to come out. This was the last picture I did for this series. It was called Dionysus in the House of Women. And it was in this 10 by 10 foot studio with a model stand in it. This was 8 foot wide. So it was getting very crowded in there. And it's about, and it was a very, technically it was a very complicated composition for me. It had more figures than I'd ever used. And it was about, I have a son who's now 14. I guess at this point he was 11 or 12. This was one of his friends. And it was about the transition for boys from into adolescence when they leave. It was like the one about dressing for the wedding was about leaving the world of women to go into the world of men when you get married. And this is about for a boy leaving the world of women in childhood, and his next step is to be an adolescent, is to go into the world of men. And so I wanted to make him in a sort of dreaming state. He's neither in this world nor in the next one, but he's sort of surrounded by these bustling women doing women's things together, and he's just waiting. I also have two sisters and no brothers, so men have always been a mystery to me and continue to be fascinating but different, you know. And this, I put this one in to show that I think I was developing technically as well. You know, the work was getting stronger and I was able to do more with it, what I wanted it to do. It's another example, I mean another detail. Let's see. After I finished the Greek Myth series, I did nothing for a while. Sat around in my studio and with my children. I had three by this time. And then I began to have a real urge to draw African American. And it had started during the last series. I began, I'd always wanted to not just draw white people, but it was very difficult to get models. I'd been drawing from life. And I finally got a few models, but they wouldn't come for long. And I really felt a need to do this. I don't know whether it was, I felt it was a community that was close to me, but it was part of my culture and my neighborhood, my community, and it was close to me, and it was a great loss to me. There was something there that was different than what I had. And it's partly idealized, but it's partly true. You know, there was something there. There was a sameness and a difference, And I wanted it. You know, I wanted to be part of it. I wanted to be, to enter that. And so I couldn't get models. And also at this point I realized that when I was drawing from life, I would often lose my original image. I would know what I wanted it to be, but I would get so tempted and entranced by what was in front of me that I would know I wanted this whole half of the picture to be greener, you know, to do that, because it would be an emotional thing. But by the end of it, it would be all pinks and yellows, because that's what I saw there. So I was losing what I wanted. So I decided I would draw from black and white photographs and make up my own colors. And that would solve the model problem. And also, I would be able to get a wider range of expression, and I'd be able to have people moving. I mean, it was very exciting thought. So this was the first picture I did in the series, and it's not very big. It's about a foot wide. And it was just experimenting. It was still, you can see the watercolor on the right when it hasn't been covered up. It was still pastel over watercolor. But I was, it was very exciting to me. Let you have the answer. Thank you. Then I started going out and meeting people because I needed the photographs. So I started calling whoever I knew who had African American friends, and then I would call up people and say, can I look at your family photograph albums? Do you have any black and white photographs? And a lot of people were very suspicious. They didn't want to know. They didn't want to trust me. A lot of people only had a few pictures. I went to see a man in the central area where my studio was, near his house. And he had taken pictures. He was an older man. He'd taken pictures all his life for different magazines and newspapers and things. And when I showed him the work I was doing, he agreed to let me borrow some pictures. And this was from one of his photographs. And again, I was making up the colors. I could make the people any color I wanted. It was really fun. But still, it's about people. It's about relationships between people. Thank you. This one is called Sailors. And these are the toughest men in my pictures to date at this point. And I like the relationship between the man and his friend and the man and his girlfriend. And then this was from the 40s, this original photograph, and then the civilians and the sailors. It was also from it was a little tiny part of a larger photograph. That one's about 5 feet wide. The one before was about 5 feet wide. This one is smaller. This was from an old woman who's 80 years old now, and she's the little girl in the picture, and this was from her only family photograph. You know, someone came and put the black cloth over their head and took with their big camera and took this picture. It was the most beautiful photograph, and the children were the same age as my children. And I realized I was often attracted to these pictures because they reminded me of either my family or pictures in my family album or pictures in the American family.
This is the observer, the interpreter, the absorber of impressions. And I find that that suits not only my personality, but also the sense of who I am, because I need a great deal of time to myself in order that the impressions that I'm receiving every moment of every waking day, I need that time to synthesize and process. And I use my art, I believe, as a means of communication with others. And I rarely work within a theme. Most often it's just an expression of some individual moment. But I was in the Ukraine last year, attended the first international symposium for stone carvers. And while I was there, several women approached me, and they were very interested and concerned about American women, how the feminist movement in the United States had affected them, both professionally and privately in their lives. And I felt I was the wrong person to be asking, but needless to say, they did have these questions. And because of the language barrier, I felt that I didn't do a very good job in trying to address their concerns. So when I returned to the United States, I had with me an invitation for the following year, which was 93, to exhibit my work throughout the Ukraine. And I decided that what I would do would be a series of images about women. And the series was titled Feminine Mystique. And in this series, I was going to attempt to address some of their questions, but also try to capture what is the essence of femininity, and what does it mean in the 20th century to be a woman. And it's up to those who view my work to see and to judge whether I came even close to giving an answer to some of the questions on this issue. I came late into sculpting. I'd always had an interest in art. As a little girl, I remember instead of playing with dolls, I always had a notebook and pencils with me, constantly sketching. But I was a foster child and went through a series of homes as I was growing up. And I was determined that I was going to attend university. And the way that I felt that I would do that would be through academics. And so instead of going into the art, I followed another course, which was a very strong interest area for me, and that was in the study of language and literature. And I was able to attend university through scholarships and then went into the teaching profession. A lot of my work deals with mythology and very strong interest that I have. It wasn't until the early 80s that I even took an art class. And then I was hooked. And by 1985, I had my first professional showing. And I have to say, I've been extremely fortunate. I don't know if it's in part because of my pernacity. And I talk my way into situations. But I have been able to, as Lucretia said, work in an art foundry, and I learned step by step the casting process, and from there I left for Europe, and I actually went over with the University of Georgia Studies Abroad program as a student and ended up in Italy teaching for them stone carving, which is my true area of expertise and it's where my passion lies. While I was there, I met the owner of the marble studio in Carrara, and he saw my work and invited me to work in Carrara, which I did for 3 months. And while I was there, I learned the techniques of pointing, which is enlarging your study, and also many other techniques in terms of polishing and working with various hand tools and pneumatic tools. So I'd like to tell you a little bit about the process that I use in terms of bringing forth an idea and where I gather inspiration. At times, it can come from just a phrase in music, and it suggests an image. Often, and just a movement of a line. And with that in mind, I create a piece of sculpture. I like to work with what we call the subtraction method, and that's where you remove material from a form. I have worked with clay and used the addition process. I don't particularly care for it. To me, it's not as challenging. It isn't as demanding. And so that's why I've turned to carving. And I started with wood carving and moved from wood carving to stone. And in between, I do the lost wax bronze castings. But the studies, the maquettes that I do for the bronze are also carved. I do not start with a pattern that's created in clay. I use a particular type of foam, and I do the carving. Again, it's because I like the challenge. Once you take a section of the material away, you can't put it back. And you have to think three-dimensionally all the time, because what you do in one area affects the form in all of its other dimensions. So I would like to get started, and I'll talk about the pieces. The first approximately 20 pieces that you see are from the series that I created titled Feminine Mystique, and these are the pieces that went on tour in Lithuania and the Ukraine in this spring and summer. This is the title piece of the exhibition, and it is titled Feminine Mystique. It is bronze. It has been patinaed. Again, it was carved, as almost all of these pieces were, initially in the foam, and then a mold was made around that form, and then wax was poured into the mold, and we're ready for the foundry work. That piece stands about 18 inches high. Most of these pieces are what I would call coffee table size, because I was shipping them to Eastern Europe, and I was trying to keep the weight down on the forms. Please ask questions as I go along. I'm not intimidated at all. Okay. This is my version of the modern Helen of Troy. This is called Helen Moderne. And working in angles primarily. And how this form came about, the story of Helen has always been one that's been rather fascinating to me. And the beauty, that physical beauty that she projected, and you don't really know much about her as a person. And so this form, I feel, is somewhat cold and austere, and yet there, I feel, is grace and still beauty in the line. And that's how I perceive this piece. And it just, this was my feeling, excuse me, about Helen of Troy, and this is the image that came through. Okay. I have a problem in terms of the feminist movement in America, and in that I feel the pendulum swung too far, and the extremists have come to the front, and they're making it very difficult for men and for women in today's society. And I think Helen would fit right in to that portion of the spectrum. This is titled Entangled, and of course it's a male-female involved in love wrestling. And yeah. And this too is part of what being a woman and the interaction with male-female is all about. And as opposed to the Helen of Troy image, I think this is very warm, even though it's bronze, you know, which has a tendency to be a cold material. There's, to me, in the movement and the mingling of the two forms, there's the warmth that comes out of a relationship between a man and a woman. Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there is a tension in the form, but there's also an entanglement that just suggests the play. Yes, and that was deliberate in the selection of the patina. On the Helen of Troy image, the patina is actually a new coloration that's on the market, and it's called a gunmetal gray. And it's like a mallard duck's neck. You know, when light hits it, it'll vary in the color tones, the colors of the spectrum. That's what the gunmetal gray patina will do, but it still has an icy, cold quality to it, whereas this patina is a warm golden undertone and selected specifically for this piece. Yes. Patinas are applied primarily through chemical bath and heat. Mm-hmm. You want to see it all the way around? Pardon? They're asking if they can go back to the first two slides because with the lights out, it's so much clearer. God/goddess. And she's somewhat of the flaneur, the observer. Not a commentator, but just an absorber of impressions. And it's my statement. I believe that there is a creative spirit out there and that we are all a part and portion of that energy. And I don't adhere to it being male or female, but if one had to put the concept into a actual mass, this was my interpretation, at least of a portion. This is titled Passionata, and the coloration there, it doesn't show it as well. It's actually more red. And this is how I perceive the passion, the creativity, the energy that is within us, and that passes from one of us to the other and back again. And so it's cyclical. It seems to have many detours and blocks, but there is no beginning. There is no end. This is the only piece that wasn't created specifically for this series. This was actually done in 1985, and it's titled La Madeleine. And it's the traditional religious aspect of womanhood, the Virgin. And Mary is often associated with the lily, and so I incorporated the image of the mother-child within the lily form. This is the same, but with a high luster, meaning that no coloration was put onto the bronze. It was just polished to this sheen. And my bronzes, I never do a series over 11. They're always done. This is a series of 7. I just feel that if people invest in my work, it should be truly an investment that's... they're not going to find 100 of my pieces, same pieces out, that it, I feel, is a more personal sharing. Lebenslust, and it means lust for life. And I hate to direct people in terms of my thought process, but this is what you're asking for. And this, for me, is the sperm searching for the egg. Again, it's life-affirming. Yes. Mm-hmm. No. No. You know, I don't feel that I often have a choice. The image is there and has to come out, and it does. I can't explain it any more than that. And there will be pieces later that of forms that are very strong angles and planes. And prior to that, my work and since has been what I call a stylized abstract, the very sweeping curves and very sensuous. So I don't know where those forms came from, but they were there and they had to be expressed, and they are. They just exist. But we're all complex personalities, and I think the work, especially of artists, reflects this. Okay. This piece is titled Affirmation, and it's actually the study that was created for a piece that I did for Bellarmine Preparatory High School in Tacoma, and it's an 8-foot by 4-foot by 4-foot marble that's out in their central drive. And again, when I talked with the school personnel and the student body before I put forth this image, and I asked them how they felt about their campus and their school. What did they feel that they gained by attending this private school as opposed to a public school? And they all were telling me that the program there was so nurturing, and yet it opened them to the world. And then I was also able to talk with people who had graduated, had been out in the world, and had come back to Bellarmine and supported the programs there strongly. And they were saying the same thing, that it had been a nurturing, enriching environment and prepared them for the world, and yet gave them a sense of security, a sense of self. And that's how this form came about, based on what they were telling me the school and the community there meant to them. This is Joyeux, and it's just an expression of life being a pleasure, a joy. Bronze. Mm-hmm. And this piece is titled Androgyny. It's the male-female within us. And again, that is an aspect of an expression of the feminine. So. This piece is titled Chi, and I don't know, I happen to be watching a television program with Bill Moyers on Oriental philosophy, and they were talking about qi being the source or the center of energy, not being the heart, not being the lungs, but being in the lower section of the body. And as he was talking, this image came to me. And so this is my impression of the concept of chi, of life's energy and source of energy. Right, these are molds. Mm-hmm. Right. But often in the work that I do with the stone, I let the stone suggest the image. And I know that you all know the story that Michelangelo supposedly saw the image within the stone and had it speak to him. And there's some truth to that. The very movement of the grain pattern in the stone will often suggest the form that's there. This piece is titled Contemplation, and it's one of the series of in this of the muse image of the reflective woman. This is femme moderne. I was trying to express the woman who has self-esteem, who knows who she is, knows what she wants from life, and goes for it. So there's that sense, I hope I achieved it, of movement and of strength and yet still of femininity. And again, I chose the patina carefully to make sure that it had a warm undertone instead of cold. Go ahead. This piece is titled Sisyphus. Again, it's in response to a myth. And it's my image. And this is fabricated as well as cast bronze. Okay. This is a fabricated piece of bronze, and by fabricated, I mean it's sheet metal that's been welded. And this is titled Eye of the Needle. And it is large. It's stands, just the piece itself stands almost 5 feet. Okay. Again, this is another view of that same piece. Mm-hmm. Again, another. This is a side view. This is one of the wood pieces. This is actually one of my first pieces that when I began carving, and this is in black walnut. And this is called The Birth of a Pea. It's, again, a celebration of life. And I think all forms of life have to be respected. And this is my statement of that. I'm very much into yoga and Eastern philosophy, and this is my view of the bow position, the Dhanurasana. And this is in alabaster. This is marble, and this is Gaia, the Earth Mother. She's. And this is titled Mira, and it's in response to a poem that I read by a Pakistani woman in the 7th century AD. And she was talking about awaiting the return of her lover. Well, her lover was Krishna. And so there, I hope that I captured this sense of bemusement, just waiting. And that's Carrara marble. This is a piece of marble. I quarry a lot of my own stone, and this came off of Vancouver Island. And this is titled Odysseus, and it stands almost 8 feet high on its pedestal. And it was meant to capture the strength of and the energy that men have within their physical form as well as in their spiritual. This is not showing well. This is a piece of Portuguese alabaster, and it's in greens and red and orange. And it's three women, and it's titled The Gossips. And this piece is bronze. It was originally in stone, in alabaster, and I made a mold. And this is titled Menelaus. And if you recall your mythology, Menelaus was the husband of Helen of Troy, the warrior king. He had strength, but he also was self-centered and very egocentric and tried to portray that in the form. This is the piece that I created in the Ukraine at the International Symposium last year. It's 7.5 feet high. It's red granite. Unfortunately, the color doesn't show that well, but it's titled Firebird, based on their myth, which is very similar to our myth of the phoenix, but the bird rising from the ashes. That piece, by the way, did take first place last year. So, exciting time. And another view of it. It's on permanent site in Nikolaev, Ukraine. And that was another view. On the wings of the bird itself, there's carved an environmental message, you know, stating how important it is to preserve, to protect, to revere the environment. This is the piece that I created in Lithuania this year at Central Europa Sculpture Park, and it's titled Cat's Cradle. It's actually stands almost 6 feet. It's red granite, and it's been highly polished on the top, and that stainless steel, and it's a double nest. And within the nest is the red egg symbolizing the life force, the beginning of life. No, it's sculpted. Because when you touch the stainless steel mesh, it rocks. Mm-hmm. Okay. And this is just showing it a little closer so that you can see the high sheen on the, and the reflective quality from that sheen on the surface of the granite. And I believe that's close to the last, yes. But I feel that I've been very fortunate in that I'm able to do what is my passion and able to express myself. Sometimes I feel it makes me too vulnerable. I don't at times feel that comfortable. People get in too close to me. And I say that because it is a concern when you put your work out before the public that you want them to have an understanding of the work and to appreciate it, but sometimes you feel that you've revealed just a little bit too much of your own psyche. It does, at least it makes me somewhat squeamish at times. Yes. No, I never envisioned this 20 years ago. I think we go, you know, and through life's journey in stages, and it prepares us for the next step. And I don't feel that I was ready to pursue this until I did. And then I knew that that was right for me. Okay. Let me see. Are you going to?
Well, I'll tell you a story now, and
let your minds create their own images. I think that's one of the wonderful things about stories, is that we can let our imaginations form the images that are important to each of us and let the story take us and work with us in ways that we probably don't know at the time. I came to storytelling through my love of stories as a girl. I was an avid reader, especially of fairy tales and fantasy, and started reciting poetry, memorizing and reciting poetry at an early age, sort of in competition with my three sisters, culminating in my younger sister and I both learning the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner and reciting it in tandem around the campfire. It takes a whole half hour. The wonderful thing about that is when you have to learn something, when I learned that poem, I knew in the beginning that it was a wonderful poem, and parts of it were difficult to catch. And the more that I went over and over and over it, by the 50th time or so, I would suddenly, certain parts would just click, and I'd say, oh, that was the meaning there. And certainly not the first times through did I catch it. So that's one of the things I like a lot about learning poetry and then stories. I came to stories when I was in college, and I was looking for courses that were interesting, and saw there was a storytelling course and took it and opened up a whole new world. It was like poetry, but the stories, and it's been wonderful to learn them and tell them. It seems to me that for me the hardest part of storytelling is actually finding the story that I want to tell. I have to read many, many dozens and dozens of stories before I find one that really resonates with me and that I can therefore tell in a, feel like I can get inside the story and really convey it well to an audience. That seems to me to be the creative element of storytelling. Just like the visual artist, you have to learn the craft. You have to learn how to memorize, how to learn the story. The presentation is the craft, the skill of it. But the creative part is to let yourself be open to the elements of the story and how they resonate to you and how you then, what audience you would tell what story to. The story I'm going to tell tonight is from the Northwest Coast Indians. And because of the time of year, I like it. It has a spirit child in it who helps the people and has an element of love and somewhat of redemption in it. I'd like to start with a poem by Robert Graves, which, again, just let it soak in. It's hard to tell, and there's no real meaning, I think, just the feeling of it, just of opening. It's called Warning to Children. Children, if you dare to think of the greatness, muchness, rareness, fewness of this precious, only, endless world in which you say you live, you think of things like this. Locks of slate, enclosing dappled red and green, enclosing tawny yellow nets, enclosing white and black acres of dominoes, where a neat brown paper parcel tempts you to untie the string. In the parcel, a small island. On the island, a large tree. In the tree, a husky fruit. Strip the husk and pare the rind off. In the kernel, you will see blocks of slate enclosed by dappled red and green, enclosed by tawny yellow nets, enclosed by white and black acres of dominoes, where the same brown paper parcel. Children, leave the string alone, for who dares untie the parcel finds himself at once inside it, on the island, in the fruit, blocks of slate about his head, finds himself enclosed by tawny red and green, by dappled yellow nets, by white and black acres of dominoes, with the same brown paper parcel still unopened on his knee. And then, if you dare to think of the fewness, rareness, muchness, greatness of this endless, only, precious world in which you say you live, you then untie the string. And this is the story of the wild woman of the woods. Just go back to childhood and let me tell you a story. There was once a young girl named Bidal. She was a Ravencrest child of the Tsimshian tribe of Indians on the northwest coast. The cedar houses of her village fronted along a beach, almost pushed into the sea by the dark timbered mountains behind it. When the tide was high, the carved portal pole of her home nearly waded in the water. Vidal loved beautiful things, and she often found people grew impatient with her when she lingered behind on a forest trail, searching for tiny pink bells among the lacy mosses, or when she lay awake at night and wanted to talk about the starry sparks that leapt toward the smoke hole. An older girl, Gundex, slept next to her on the sleeping platform and was especially impatient with Vidal. At night, when she tried to talk to her, she would say, "Oh, hush, Vidal, and don't be such a nuisance." Or if she were especially cross, she would say, "Oh, do be quiet, you stupid child, or Teslamokug will get you." Teslamokug was the wild woman of the woods, also called a basket ogress, a giantess. She captured unwary children. She would carry them away in her basket, shut their eyes with pitch, and take them back to her horrid home and devour them. Vidal was terrified of her, and when Gundex would threaten her like this, she would shiver down into her rabbit skins and try not to look at the towering house post carved in the image of the giantess. It had staring holes for eyes and a rounded calling mouth and ears spread wide to catch the slightest murmur. Sometimes when Gundex had really terrified Vidal, she would sneak away and leave her, and Gundex would sob and have a nightmare. But Gundex was unconcerned. And so it went, until one lovely day when the sun was shining on the rocky beach and the seaweed was crackling and steaming. Women in loose brown cedar garments came to the beach with their digging sticks in their baskets to dig the sprouting clams and to dry as many as they could for winter. And the children came along to play. They were sent down to the far end of the beach where Gundex would watch them, cross as ever. Vidal came along too with her little basket full of shells held by a forehead tump line on her bare brown back. She found a perfect place to search for more shells and climbed on top of a jagged rock. Her mother, Sudal, urged her to go and stay with Gundex and the children as she was worried about the rocks, but Vidal begged and pleaded, and at last her mother let her stay and went to search for clams. She loved the little limpet shells especially, the ones that were shaped like little chieftains' hats. And she found many beautiful with spiral shapes and gleaming centers and some pretty mussel shells too. Then she found a particularly beautiful limpet shell, and she called out to her mother to see it. Her mother came running and then scolded her for having her come over and take her away from her work. Ah, Vidal was sad. No one seemed to care about beautiful things, at least not when they were busy. She forgot and called her mother again, and by the third time her mother scolded her and sent her off to be with Gundex and the other children. Slowly she trudged over and found them all playing at potlatch, Gundex the chieftain, and they all scurrying around and finding gifts for giving and foods for feasting. One child dumped a lot of round white pebbles and said, "I found seagull eggs," and another was carving spoons out of kelp with a sharp mussel shell. Gundex said, "Oh, great, now I have to watch you too." "No," said Vidal, "I'll just play over here with my shells." "Oh, shells," she said, and she grabbed Vidal's basket to look inside. "Well, these will be just fine for spruce root hats for potlatch gift giving." "No," said Vidal, "they're mine. You leave them be." "Give them to me, you selfish child," cried Gundex, and they struggled over the basket, and Vidal kicked and kicked at Gundex, trying to protect her treasures. And Gundex hit at the flailing child, and at last, frustrated, stamped her foot and said, "You horrid child, I'll show you." And she turned to the woods, and she cupped her hands and called, "Teslamokug, come for Vidal! Teslamokug!" Children all stopped, horrified. What a brash summons! They all stood silent, waiting. She started to call again when suddenly the tall hemlock branches parted, and there was Teslamokug, her staring eyes looking straight at them. a forehead tump line across her forehead, carrying her huge basket. In her hand, she held a nettle salmon net. Vidal fell to the ground, sobbing, and Gundax, too, stopped in her tracks, horrified at what she had actually done. The other five children were all rooted to the spot. Teslamoka gave one great cry of triumph, threw her net over all of them, and pulled them in as a salmon catcher catches salmon, and then she dumped them into her basket like a salmon catch. The children cried, but their cries for help were drowned in the wailing wind and then muffled by the mosses and trees as she started trudging back into the woods with them. She stopped to close their eyes with pitch and then fixed the net tight across the basket. Vidal lay almost paralyzed with fright. At last, her worst nightmare come true. Her eyes were shut with pitch. She was being brought deeper and deeper into the woods, farther and farther to... Oh, she didn't dare think. The only one who saw them go was a crafty old raven, maybe 80 years old, who had been watching them play and who now followed them stealthily, silently, deeper and deeper into the woods, following to see where they would go. Gundax started, as soon as she got over her immediate fear, started scolding Gundax. "Vidal, you stupid child," she said. "This is all your fault. If you hadn't been so selfish..." And she started climbing on top of the other children to get to the top of the basket. "I'll get out of here," she said. But the net was tight across the top, double-layered, and she couldn't get out. "Even if you did," piped up the boy, "how would you ever find the way? If only we could leave a trail." My shells," said Vidal. And Gundax grabbed the basket when she found it and started throwing some shells out. Then her hand was cut on the sharp mussel shell in there, and so she pulled it out and started sawing with it and cut a hole in the net. When it was finally big enough for her, she stuck her hand out, throwing more shells, until her hand was brushed by a large branch. And she grabbed it with both her strong arms and was pulled out of the basket, leaving the little other children jogging farther and farther into the forest with Teslamoka. She managed to climb the branch to the trunk and down and got herself down to the mossy ground. There she got the pitch out of her eyes as best she could and started looking around. The forest was silent and damp and eerie, still as a graveyard. It was awful. At last she saw glowing over there a little limpet shell, and she ran over and picked it up, and she dropped it in the basket that she had with her, and the sound of it was very reassuring. And so then she followed the trail. She'd forgotten all about the other children by now. And she just picked up each shell as she came to it and plunked it in to hear the reassuring sound. And so finally she saw light through the trees and came out and saw the cedar houses of her village and people running toward her. "Gundax, Gundax, where are the others?" She said, "Teslamoka kept them. I tried to help. And when I couldn't, I escaped myself and I left a trail of shells." And they said, "And where is it?" "Well, I, you picked it up, you stupid wretch!" She had been so selfish she hadn't given a thought to them. Sudal, Vidal's mother, said, "Well,
and that is the end of the tape. Copyright CGU and Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.